Hello, and welcome to Episode 7 of The Infectious Myth. I'm your host, David Crow, and I'm very pleased to welcome two guests today, co-authors of a new book on vaccination, Dissolving Illusions. But before I welcome them, let me welcome some feedback. We got our first really positive email message from John DeLuca, an MD in Palm Beach Integrative Medicine. I just wanted to let you know that I think the show is fantastic. Keep up the good work. If you'd like to leave feedback, ask a question, or suggest another guest, you can email me at david.crow, and that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. And if you're listening to the show as a podcast, don't forget you can listen live on prn.fm at 2 p.m. Eastern Time every Tuesday. And if you listen live, you can call in by dialing the PRN studio at 888-874-4888. But let's get to our guests. Susan Humphries is an MD internist and board-certified nephrologist, currently in private practice as a holistic practitioner. And she's currently in the Southern Hemisphere, where it's very early in the morning. So I hope she's managed to join us. Suzanne, are you with us yet? Doesn't sound like she's joined us yet, but we will keep trying to get... We'll keep trying to get her. Also with us is Roman Bistriniak, I hope I haven't butchered that name too badly, who has been researching the history of diseases and vaccines since 1996. He has an extensive background in health and nutrition as well as degrees in engineering and computer science. Roman, are you with us?
Yes, I think I am.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll start with you while we sort out the problems with... Suzanne, who's down under right now, and
sure.
And I know she's awake because we've been communicating on Skype, but
technical things, right?
Yes, there's always these technical things. So, Roman, your original background was not really in health. So, how did you go from engineering and computer science to health? Is there any connection between your education and your interest in health and diseases?
Well, I have a classical engineering education, so I know how to analyze things, analyze problems, solve problems. I do that every day with computers, computer programs. I got into health because my own failing health many years ago. I just wasn't feeling good, and I won't go into a long story, but I turned a lot of that around by doing my own reading and changing my diet and taking nutrients. And that was all really just a surprise to me because, you know, I was pretty mainstream. I ate junk food, I drank a lot, and did all the things you're not really supposed to, but no one ever told me anything different.
Most people do anyway.
Right, so nobody ever told me anything different. So I thought, you know, this is just normal.
But, and so how did that morph into an interest in vaccines? Like, obviously, that sort of tells you how important nutrition and other things are to health.
Right.
But what about vaccines?
Well, I had kids, and when I started, I was pretty much, you know, not really thinking about vaccines much. It was just kind of a given. I would say I would have to be pro-vaccine because I believed at the time that, you know, all these diseases were wiped out by these vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, you know, there might be a couple of problems here and there, but, you know, it's well worth it because it's for the public good and all that. But... Because of my, you know, experience with health and, you know, I decided to do a little bit more research and I started doing some more reading and it really just opened my eyes that, you know, what you hear necessarily from the media or from other people, doctors, isn't necessarily what's really written about in the medical literature.
Right.
So that's how I got my foot in the door. And at one point I ran across a particular book that had a graph in it. And that graph showed that the mortality rate for measles had declined by 98% before they came out with a vaccine. And that really just simply kind of blew me. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, those graphs were a big surprise to me. I had a degree in biology and mathematics, and I accepted everything. I got vaccinated. I had a little card with all the list of all my vaccines, and
sure.
I just thought it was totally normal, and so any questions about vaccines were a total shock to me.
Right. I saw that graph, it simply just, I just sat there and I looked at it and I said, Well, they both can't be true. You know, they right. didn't get rid of all the diseases and solve all our problems, and this graph is true. So I didn't trust right. the graph. I went to the library and, you know, just got to open up an almanac, and they had, like, points every 10 years. And I just took out a piece of graph paper and graphed it, and it matched the graph in the book. And I'm, And really, I became kind of a statistics junkie.
Right.
And those 10 points or so just weren't enough for me, so I just went to the Yale Medical Library and started getting more and more data. And right. I just kept on gathering data from the United States, England, Massachusetts, went to various libraries, and put all this stuff into spreadsheets to actually get the real data
right.
as close to the source as possible. And that's how you see all the graphs right. in the book. And by the way, all the graphs are available on dissolvingillusions.com.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know. I didn't realize that. We actually have Suzanne with us right now. Suzanne, you can hear us?
Yes, I can hear you fine. Thank you.
Hi, yeah. Suzanne.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. I know it's very early in the morning for you, so you're going to get a good early start on the day. We just heard from Roman how somebody with a degree in engineering and computer science got interested in vaccines. So perhaps you can describe to us how a mainstream MD would start to ask questions and critique the process of vaccination.
Okay. Well, for me, it was pretty clear and simple, is that patients are being rolled into the emergency room with previously having normal kidney function and then having full-blown dialysis-dependent kidney failure. And several of them offered to me the comment that they were fine until they had that flu shot. And this was in 2009 when the two flu shots were given separately. And so after that, I decided to start paying closer attention and adding that into my history. When was your latest vaccination? And I found that adding that simple question to my history and physical examination for every new patient led to some rather startling and interesting information, especially doing inpatient consults where it was very clear what the kidney function was when they entered the hospital, what was done to them as far as drugs and medications and surgeries, and when the vaccine came into play and when the kidney failure developed. And I saw that there was a correlation. So that's really what kind of awakened me to start looking farther. And ironically, what really got me into researching heavily was the resistance that I received from the medical administration when I right. pointed out to them that it may be a good idea to withhold vaccines in people who are having heart attacks, who are actively septic, who have cancer and on chemotherapy, who have Guillain-Barré syndrome and are getting plasmapheresis, that perhaps we should wait until the day of discharge instead of the day one of their admission before giving them a flu shot. And I was told that vaccines are safe and effective and that they need to be given as quickly as possible in the hospital because they take weeks to work. And I was told that polio was eradicated by vaccines. And I was told that smallpox was eradicated by vaccines. And what was my problem? And at that point, I had no basis to argue because I was under the same illusion that most medical doctors are, which as we talk about in the book, that, you know, Jonas Salk was a hero and polio right. was wiped out because of the first injections and then the oral vaccines, and that smallpox disappeared because of Edward Jenner's invention. But when I actually went to the medical textbooks that were available back during the time, and when I saw what Roman had uncovered in his research, it was nothing short of jaw-dropping for me, and I just became really interested in knowing as much as I could about polio at that point. Period, and that's where it all started for me.
All right, and have you had quite a bit of pushback from the medical establishment? You're part of it in a sense.
Well, it's really interesting, you know, because doctors are as variable as non-doctors as mm-hmm. far as their thinking and their permeability to rationality.
Right.
You know, most of them started out the way I did, either agnostic or thinking that vaccines are necessary and that they're harmless and effective. And mm-hmm. there were, you know, I had a lot of conversations with different doctors in my last 2.5 years in the hospital. And I found that most people, if you gave them enough information, they had to at least start thinking twice about what they were doing. And I did see a slow evolution in their minds. You know, there were some doctors that came up to me the second year and said, you know, well, I didn't get my own flu shot this year because last year I thought I was being a good citizen by doing it, but now I realize that not only is it not necessarily preventing my patients from becoming ill like I thought it would, but I was sicker than ever last year and I got the flu anyway. I had another medical partner who, you know, started looking into the Gardasil vaccine because he had a 12-year-old daughter and he was not happy about her having to get a vaccine for sexually transmitted disease. So that was kind of the gateway in his mind. And by the way, if you don't know, that Japan has actually suspended their mandatory Gardasil, sorry, it wasn't Gardasil, they're at Cervarix HPV vaccine program, thanks to a group of dedicated scientists. Just wanted to throw that in there. I just received word of that this morning.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it seems like a very structured society, and so if people are told do this, you know, most people will without questioning it. So that's a big step for them to undo this. I noted that in the regarding HPV, which I'm not sure that's in your book. I didn't finish the whole book, but in the Nobel Prize citation for the HPV vaccine, it says something like it will be decades before we know if this vaccine will actually have an impact on the rate of cancer. And yet, it's considered to be mandatory on the basis that it reduces precursor signs to cancer, which may not actually be related to cancer. But let's go back from the current day to the beginning of your book, where you go well into, I guess, the 1700s, and one of the messages I get was that with the Industrial Revolution, overcrowded cities, the working class was very poor, there were no real social services, they lived in bad housing, had bad nutrition, and that was actually the cause of much of the illness in that population. Is that kind of the short summary of quite a long section in your book?
Right, yeah, we started out the book with that because I think it was important for people to know that things weren't all rosy and wonderful like you might see in the movies or read about. People had awful nutrition. You know, people were dying of scurvy, which is a gross vitamin C deficiency, and it's a horrible, horrible death. And there was no sanitation because there was no toilets, so everything just went out the window. And, of course, that would infect your water supply. And there was no refrigeration, so all your food, you know, if it was not just freshly gotten, which was not true in the cities, was already putrid and rotting.
Right.
And what people did eat was just basically meats and refined biscuits, drank a lot of alcohol.
Right.
And, you know, you take all those together, and it's a recipe for, you know, disaster. Your whole immune system is compromised. And all these diseases spread rampant.
Right.
Yeah.
There was
you know, there was something else that was in short supply back during that time, and that was mothers. There were very high rates of maternal death during childbirth because doctors were refusing to wash their hands, even though physicians proved that just simply washing in a solution of lime brought the death rate down from as high as 35% at childbirth down to zero. And guess what happened? Happens if you don't grow up with a mother. You're either wet nursing or you're getting powdered milk somehow. And so if you do survive, your immune system is severely compromised. Your father is stressed out. You're going to go work in a factory somewhere as early as you can possibly use your hands. And I believe that was also a major part of what happened back then with the susceptibility.
Yeah, you had children, you know, young children, 5 years old, working in mines, working in factories. Mm-hmm. Having horrible food, no life at all, and you know it was just abysmal. And with you just had to have all these horrible problems.
Right. One of the things that struck me about that section is it was a real, it was a lot of praise for the people who pushed forward public health in the way, not in terms of vaccinating people, but in terms of putting in sewer systems. Improving living conditions, improving labor conditions, banning child labor, all of those things, those must have made a huge, must have had a huge impact on people's health over, say, the 1800s.
Right. That's a health revolution, as we like to call it, that really changed everything. And we have to thank plumbers and people who were all into improving the nutrition of the people and hygiene and putting in labor laws and electricity and all these things.
All of those things are innovations, actually.
Right. All those things together is what really changed everything. It's not doctors and vaccines or antibiotics, all those types of things. And it's just a basically, essentially a forgotten history. And it's really an incredible revolution that it took place.
Right. One of my observations about people who oppose vaccinations is there's more support for this idea on the right of the political spectrum. A lot of people consider it an infringement on individual liberties, and I would say that's true today. I mean, I'm not from a right-wing persuasion, and I know not all vaccine critics are, but there seems to be a much larger, you know, sort of trend on that side. And yet what your section is saying is that there was the people who believed in society working together for the betterment of all, which you could consider like socialism or something, who actually made a huge impact on the health of these people. And I fear that we're now going back with, you know, reductions in wages and reductions in regulations to try to reduce the burden on corporations. We're heading back towards the Victorian era.
Well, this is the problem with not knowing history, which we don't really know about this. These social structures changed everything.
Yes.
And we don't appreciate that, so we just think, well, it's just, you know, every individual is for himself, and I don't think that's true. These social structures are very important. They took these plagues. There was six major cholera pandemics from the early 1800s to early 1900s. Those are gone because of social structures, because of sanitation, because of improvement in water supplies. Same thing with all these infectious diseases. They all went away basically because of plumbers.
And we're talking about diseases that affect thousands or millions of people, whereas today you can get an epidemic declared with like six cases.
We had typhus and typhoid and cholera. These were killing millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
These were real epidemics. I mean, these were just epidemics and pandemics.
Yeah, you know, the other thing is that, you know, it wasn't just that things got bad in the 1700s and then they got better. You know, the truth is that back in history, for hundreds of years, 500, thousands of years, people were living into their 70s and 90s. It's not as we hear that the life expectancy was 40 and now it's up to 70 or 80. I mean, when people live in peace, when they're not at war, when they're not overcrowded, when they're eating fresh grown produce or living off the land, they don't have these disease epidemics to the degree that they did when they were taken out of that situation, for instance, in England, when the peasants were forced off the land where they were doing fine and brought into the cities and they were forced to work in the cities in these horrible conditions. That's when we saw the epidemics. And now we see it go in the opposite direction. You know, Russia had been doing okay as far as diphtheria went. And then when the USSR collapsed, things got really hard for Russia and alcoholism increased, food decreased, and they saw again an increase in diphtheria. So you can see it go in both directions. And it really depends on what human beings are doing, what their nutrition is, what their stress level is, because stress increases cytokines and it decreases the immunity. It doesn't matter where the stress comes from. Then you add malnutrition to that, and you've got a perfect fertile ground for an epidemic.
Right. Yeah, I think we're having more and more people, you know, working minimum wage, which is shockingly low, and working three or four jobs to try to put together enough hours to keep their heads above water. I mean, that has to be extremely stressful, especially if they have a family. And how does a mother today breastfeed if she's got to go back to work because she can't survive without working?
Well, there are ways that she can do it. It would involve expressing milk and having a flexible work situation. But it's really, you know, there's no substitute for human milk. You know, you can look at these packages of what, formula does. But when it really gets down to it, they're still discovering components in human milk that they didn't know about before. There are anti-cancer molecules in there. There are agents in breast milk, defensins that basically are nuke pneumococcal bacteria, Anopheles influenza and all these bacteria that we supposedly need to vaccinate for. Well, guess what? The breast milk is actually, it's an extension of the placenta. And that period of the mother-infant dyad is 3 years long. And I just, you know, if a mother can't hang on to her baby for that long, then that baby is going to be put at a disadvantage as far as its immune system goes for the rest of its life. I mean, this is not fringe information. I don't make this up. It's in our own medical literature, and it's been there for quite a long time.
Yes. Well, I hope to at some point soon interview Marion Thompson, one of the founders of the Hull Alesh League, to talk more detail about breastfeeding, which I'm also interested in. I think everybody should be, because it's how we hopefully get a good start in life. But let's go back to vaccinations. Let's talk about smallpox as the first example where you have an extensive literature about what smallpox was, how it changed over time, and what impact, if any, the vaccination had. So can we start like with what smallpox is? Because most people have forgotten, have never encountered it.
Does anyone take it?
Okay. Well, I'll take it if you want to. Well, what smallpox is certainly, you know, that's a really good question because, you know, now that we have polymerase chain reaction and more sophisticated science in order to be able to determine where these diseases come from and what kind of animals they evolved from, we have some really interesting information, which we did detail in the book. But basically back, you know, in the 1700s and actually even thousands of years ago, there are reports of what probably were smallpox. And it's basically a viral illness that's inhaled and eventually ends up with pustules that can be very painful throughout the body. That causes a lot of scarring. It can actually accumulate pox in the throat, and asphyxia can occur. Now, what history tells us is that in people who were well cared for, well tended, and well nourished, that smallpox did not have to be a deadly disease. But back during these times when you have, well, say, the fertile soil for deadly epidemics to occur and people's immune systems were really beaten down for all the reasons we talked about, smallpox was quite deadly. Now, where did smallpox come from? It is a viral disease, you know, when It probably started in humans. However, they were unable to make a vaccine from the human pox. So because when they made a vaccine from the human pox, they basically found that epidemics started from the vaccine, and these epidemics were quite deadly. So then the concept came that if we got pox from a cow and made a vaccine out of that and injected it into people's skins, that this would prevent them from developing smallpox. However, these were completely uncontrolled experiments. We don't know if the people they used the smallpox, cowpox vaccines on actually already had smallpox. We don't know the histories. There was no control group, and there were certainly plenty of people who developed full-blown smallpox after having these cowpox vaccines. And eventually what seems to have happened is that there was a new strain of virus that became a hybrid of probably cowpox, goat pox, and maybe even horse. And that's what consisted the virus that was used up to modern day times in our vaccines. And the theory is that the similar virus will provoke immunity that will be cross-reactive to a smallpox virus, a wild smallpox virus. And I wrote a paragraph or two extensively on that evolution of the of that virus and the hybridization from, you know, there was passage of you know, today we have vaccine companies that make, you know, fairly purified vaccines. I should say relatively fairly purified vaccines, where back then the way a vaccine was made is you would scratch what you thought was a virus onto a cow's belly, wait for it to erupt in pustules, scrape it off, put it into glycerin, and then just put like a little, it was like a little tiny sharp fork into it and just start poking it into people. And then you could rub arm to arm to spread it, and so all kinds of human diseases were spread throughout, and it became a virus of who knew what it was, and it differed from town to town. Some towns they would just get scabs from people who had the pox and break it up and shake it up into a fluid and use that. So there are all kinds of different things in that vaccine.
And you describe how, I mean, it was basically forced on people in England anyway, and was it the city of Liverpool that sort of revolted against the mandatory vaccination several people had been killed by the vaccines. People didn't want the rest of their kids vaccinated.
Right. There were more and more laws put in place in England and even in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts enacted a law in 1855 where
right.
just pretty much everybody was vaccinated. Same thing in England. But it really didn't help. If you actually look at the statistics, there's more people that died after the 1855 law than they did before the 1855 law. So it didn't do anything. And in 1872, 71, 73, there was a pandemic of smallpox. It hit all these towns, and a lot of people died, even if you were vaccinated.
Right.
So after that, people began to resist, and it was a town of Leicester, actually, Leicester, England.
Oh, Leicester, yes.
Right, where people in 1885 had a big protest, and they said, hey, we had enough. We shouldn't be forced to have these vaccines on penalty of fine or jail. And they revolted against it. And they installed a town council, and they resisted, and their vaccination rates dropped.
Because they used isolation and sanitation. Basically, if there was a case
right.
of smallpox, the case was isolated, the house was sanitized, the community got together, and then the smallpox rate plummeted after that.
Right. So it was far more successful, and yet it was these laws still stayed on the books.
But after that time and the example of Leicester, the vaccination rates went way down. They were up near 95%
mm-hmm.
before 1872. After that, they slowly went down, and they were probably around to 30% later on, and in Leicester, 10%.
Right.
And the pro-vaccine people at the time believed that was going to be a disaster. Sooner or later, there
right.
was going to be an epidemic, and you're all going to pay for it. But that never happened.
Yeah.
And it was 60 years later in Leicester, they never had a problem with smallpox, despite very low vaccination rates.
And I mean, today we sort of have the right to refuse vaccinations. I mean, they make it as difficult as possible, and sometimes you have to get a specific exemption, like a religious exemption or something else. I don't think you can have a scientific exemption, can you, if you've reviewed the science and don't believe in it?
I don't believe most states go for that at all. But we're slowly moving
back.
Nobody
will listen to science. Science is dead as far as I'm concerned when it comes to arguing against vaccines. You know, there's so much science against the infant immune system and what that is and what happens when you inject an antigen into there for, as far as brain function is concerned and as far as future function of the immune system. But that's science, and it's all in our medical literature. And the powers that be are not – are not open to the actual scientific immunologic arguments against vaccination. So even if there was an exemption, I don't believe that anyone would listen to it.
Yeah. I mean, I just heard recently that the autism rate in the U.S. is up to 1 out of 60 children. It used to be an extremely rare condition. I mean, maybe there's some sort of more awareness and more people getting diagnosed because of that, but I think that's shockingly high. And yet it's absolutely forbidden to bring up the issue of vaccines and autism
yeah.
if you look at the mainstream media.
Which is kind of interesting because if you watch the Science Channel or whatever, science is always about questioning everything, but not vaccines. Vaccines are a settled science. You're not supposed to question them at all. If you do, then you're attacked.
Well,
all
I hate
the science you can question, but not vaccines.
No, I hate to break this to you, but this is actually endemic throughout science. It's not just vaccines.
Well, there's a lot of stuff that can be questioned, but vaccines definitely not.
Yes. Let's move on to polio, which is actually an area I've done quite a bit of research myself, and I believe you used the research of Jim West in some of what you wrote. Some of his previous research into some of the earlier papers. But you talk about pesticides like arsenic prior to World War II and DDT. Can you talk about that connection with polio?
Yeah, well, if you look at the symptoms of arsenic toxicity, or if you look at the symptoms of DDT toxicity, I mean, we put that, we basically took it right out of the toxicology literature. It's identical to what the symptoms that people were complaining of with polio back in the 1940s and 1950s, diarrhea, paralysis, headaches, sore throat, fever. Those are all the symptoms of these pesticide poisonings. And, basically, if in addition to that, when you look at the spinal cord, there are lesions in the very same area that there are after a wild poliovirus invasion of the central nervous system. I know there are people out there that don't believe in viruses and they think it was all pesticide. I happen to think that there were part of the deal was that it was purely pesticide, but I also, and it's not just what I think. I mean, there have been measurements of what happens when you put a pesticide like arsenic or DDT together with a poliovirus in cells, and those cells become much more susceptible to the poliovirus. And so what happens, you know, the bowel is the center of our immunity, whether you like it or not, it is. You know, having good bowel flora, the integrity and the lining of that bowel and the lymphatics beyond that bowel are primary importance when it comes to any sort of microbial invasion. Now, if you take DDT or arsenic and you develop the diarrhea and the dysbiosis and the imbalance in that bowel and the erosion of the membrane, then what happens if you have a virus in your system, even a commensal virus? You know, we're loaded with commensal viruses, but any virus is going to have much more of an inroad to your lymphatics and to your blood system. And when it comes to polio and that wild virus or even the vaccine virus gets access to the blood, then it then can have access to the central nervous system through any peripheral nerve. And that's why oftentimes when people had an injection of any sort, they were more susceptible to polio in the limb that was injected, because if they were viremic at that time, the virus would have access to the central nervous system. So I believe that the pesticides and the viruses can work in conjunction with each other.
But you can get, with arsenic or DDT, you can get the symptoms. Symptoms are
exact
much like polio
symptoms.
Without a virus.
Absolutely exact same symptoms without a virus whatsoever. Yep.
And there were also medical interventions. I mean, this is something that I learned a little later after researching polio, that some of the things the doctors did seemed absolutely crazy. Now, you talk a lot about the binding in this sister, Elizabeth
right.
Kenny, I believe, from Australia. I didn't see anything, maybe I skipped over it, about the spinal tap issue. Like, could that not cause paralysis?
Well, you know, that's a really good point. You know, what a lot of people say to me and what I actually, you know, I had to answer a lot of my own questions when it came to polio. And, you know, I was as much of a skeptic as anybody else. And I just basically came at it from a point of I didn't know the answer and I wanted to find out the answers. And I thought to myself, well, where are all these short limbs? I mean, I knew someone and I worked in a lab. She's probably like 70 or 80 now. And she had polio and she walked with a short limb. So where are all these short limbs? Like, if polio wasn't eradicated by the vaccines and if it's still around in one form or another, where are the short limbs? Well, first of all, you know, DDT and arsenic aren't available. I mean, there's still arsenic on some farms, and there's still arsenic in
right.
well water and so on and so forth. But DDT is pretty much gone out of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But countries where you still have access to DDT, there's still polio. And anywhere that you have the kind of treatment that we had in the United States, where they would basically take a paralyzed child and immediately immobilize the limb, take them to surgery, straighten the leg, put a cast on it, and leave them in a cast anywhere from 6 months to 2 years. If you do that to anybody's limb, especially a growing child, guess what? That limb isn't going to grow properly. It's going to atrophy.
Right.
And they're going to have one shorter limb. So anywhere where you see polio treated that way, you're going to have the short limbs that we saw back in the day. As far as doing a spinal tap, yeah, does it really make any sense? You know, I just told you that any injection at all can cause virus to go back into the central nervous system through a peripheral nerve. Well, what happens if you put a needle from the outside of the body directly through into the cerebral spinal fluid? Well, absolutely, you're going to increase the chances if that person doesn't have polio and just viremic at that point. If they don't have poliomyelitis, meaning, you know, effect of the muscle from one of the nerves being affected, well, you could have put them at risk. They did a lot of spinal taps when people came into the hospital.
But why did they do spinal taps? Like, it wasn't a treatment.
Yeah.
So what are they going to tell you?
It was basically a way to tell if it was a viral infection or a bacterial infection. And they still will do that today, because you look at the different amounts of sugar and the different amounts of protein in the cerebral spinal fluid, and depending on how it's altered, it can give you information. But it wasn't necessary. You know, what was necessary back then is still what's necessary today, which is an infusion of sodium ascorbate. And Dr. Frederick Klenner was curing 100% of his cases of polio by doing that. Dr. Sandler was curing 100% of cases of polio and preventing it by keeping the sugar intake down, which was a whole other problem.
So
that,
you're talking about vitamin C
injections. Potentiated the virus.
You're talking about vitamin C injections, right, for people
That's
who
right.
don't know what ascorbate
That's
is.
Right.
And that's a powerful antioxidant. So if there was like arsenic in your body, that could help clean it up, bind to it, and get rid of it.
Yeah, it basically is an antitoxin. It's an antioxidant. It restores the liver's ability to function properly. It restores the neutrophils, which are the active cells that deal with infections that you're not already immune to. I mean, these cells can't work without proper amounts of vitamin C. And this is actually, again, it's not fringe literature. It's well established in our medical literature that vitamin C prepares and fortifies the immune system, and it also helps with wound healing. The other thing is there's a study that just came out this week showing it was a controlled phase one trial for IV vitamin C, showing a huge difference between placebo patients, patients with low dose, and patients with high dose vitamin C infusions as far as their sepsis parameters. So as far as I'm concerned, in this day and age, everybody who goes into hospital, no matter what they're in for, they're requiring a dose of vitamin C, because hospital patients all go in with low vitamin C levels.
Oh, interesting. Now, the other interesting thing I kind of touched on was the story of Sister Elizabeth Kenny. I assume she was a nun from Australia who advocated.
Yeah, she wasn't a nun. She was actually a nurse. The Australians
used to call them sisters in those days.
Yeah, once they got certified, they were called sister.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't a religious thing. Yeah, it was a medical thing.
Oh, okay. I'm not familiar with that, but I kind of remember it from my youth.
Yeah.
But she advocated physiotherapy instead of limb binding, and
exactly.
So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, she was actually a mechanical genius, is really what she was. I mean, she was an inventor, and she was self-taught for a long time, and then she went and served her time in the Army and got her nursing degree, and her And They Shall Walk is her novel. It's extremely interesting if anybody wants to read it. And she also has several textbooks that she published while she was developing her techniques for muscle reeducation. And so she, you know, she was called out into the Australian bush, and the doctor, you know, wired her and said, you know, this is polio. There's no cure. Do whatever you can. And so she looked at it, and she did her own examination without being polluted by what the medical model already thought. And they were already at that point binding limbs and cutting tendons and doing all the things that we describe in the book. Mm-hmm. And she looked at it, and she saw that there was muscle spasm in the opposite muscle that the other doctor said was muscle paralysis. And she said, these limbs aren't paralyzed, they're in spasm. And what needs to happen is relaxation of these muscles. And so she started immediately applying very hot wool packs to these muscles continuously. She had the families working on them, and it was a very labor-intensive treatment.
Right.
And once those limbs stopped spasming, she realized that the kids basically dissociated, their brains dissociated from those muscles, and they required basically a cognitive and physical reeducation of those muscles. And so she came up with techniques to do that, and the medical system wouldn't let her treat any fresh cases. They basically only tossed her the ones years later after they had, you know, crippled them with their own medical management. And she actually started turning many of those cases around. Actually, she turned them all around to some degree, and some of them right. she actually cured. But when she came to the United States, they actually let her start treating fresh patients. And she was actually able to keep them out of the iron lung with her treatment. And it was much more successful. It wasn't 100%, but it was much more successful than anything that the medical model had done to that point. And she also incorporated nutrition. She had a very strict nutritional protocol that the polio victims were to abide by. And she was probably one of the pioneers of what we know of as physical therapy today. And people who had her treatment didn't end up with shortened atrophic limbs. It was a long and short of it.
Let's turn to Roman and talk about the statistics. You seem to be the statistics guy. So do the statistics for polio support the famous Salk and Sabin vaccines as basically eliminating the epidemic? What do the statistics on polio cases tell us?
Well, I did more of the statistics on the mortality rate, so he and Suzanne probably better off talking about that anyway.
Yeah, okay, well, either I one can of tell you that the Salk vaccine statistics are readily show that the first year that vaccine was given, mm-hmm. that there were more cases of paralysis from the vaccine than there were from a wild polio. And that first year, that was due to the fact that that Jonas Salk's vaccine had a live virus in it, and it wasn't supposed to. It was supposed to be formaldehyde-killed vaccine. And there were Swedish scientists that were trying to convince the powers that be through was the infantile paralysis organization that is now the March of Dimes.
Yeah.
And so they were basically in charge through, you know, Rockefeller Institute was orchestrating all of this. And what happened was any scientist who disagreed with what was going on back then just promptly lost their funding. So eventually everybody became very agreeable, and the vaccine was developed. And that first year there was an enormous amount of paralysis, and this was known as the Qatar incident. However, it wasn't just Qatar Labs that created a vaccine that had live virus in it. Wyeth also did, and there's evidence that other companies are also producing live vaccines. This was a pretty big embarrassment, and there were a lot of lawsuits paid out at that point. Around the same time that the polio rates started to decline, as far as the statistics go, there were several things going on. So it's not cut and dry at all. What we had was an increase in breastfeeding during that period. We had a decrease in DDT use, and we had a complete overhaul of the naming system of polio. You know, right. In the beginning, polio could be diagnosed by any medical practitioner and reported as such by any medical practitioner based on a physical examination where one or more muscle groups were paralyzed on two separate physical exams within 24 hours. Well, after the vaccine was created, they changed the diagnosis criteria, and it was two examinations within 60 days. So basically, in order to be counted as polio after then, your paralysis had to persist for 60 days. Well, mind you, that most polio paralysis cases resolved within 60 days. So they didn't even need a vaccine at all to have eliminated the majority of cases of polio.
But we're talking about the statistics. The epidemic was dropping dramatically prior to 1955, which is when the polio vaccine trial occurred.
No, I don't think that statistically the numbers of polio cases were dropping prior to the vaccine. I think they were pretty much the same as they had been for years, if not higher. There was a lot of hysteria going on. You know, people were you know, any kind of illness that they had, they thought they had polio. And so, you know, hysteria can also cause paralysis. But the other thing is there were other viruses. Echovirus and Coxsackie virus can cause the identical syndrome as polio.
Right.
And then they started testing for these, you know, was there actually poliovirus evidence of it in the blood and in the stool? And what they found was that it was about a quarter of the cases that were called polio, when they actually tested them, they actually had the poliovirus evidence in the blood or the stool. So again, we knocked down cases of polio even farther by doing this specific testing.
Yeah, I mean, in your book, you actually show, I guess the peak was around 1953, but you show a dramatic decrease from 1955 to 1957, which couldn't be caused by the vaccine because the vaccine trial was only about 1 million people, of which I think half got the vaccine and half got a placebo.
That's right.
So it's pretty hard to say that the vaccine magically cured polio. And I read there's a paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association from 1960 that complains about the fact that only about half of the vulnerable population had been vaccinated, which is not enough to reduce herd immunity, and yet the epidemic had basically disappeared by 1960.
That's right. Well, the epidemic went down for, you know, there were many reasons, as mm-hmm. I just reviewed a minute ago. And, you know, by then there was the oral polio vaccine that came in. And, you know, the oral polio vaccine basically works by competition. And just like, you know, the good bacteria in your intestine will outcompete, you know, more potentially pathological bacteria in your intestine. It's the same goes with polio viruses. And so they created this oral vaccine that had three different strains of a virus that was called attenuated, meaning that they had passed it through animal after animal, monkeys, sheep, and all kinds of animals to make it basically be less virulent, meaning it would die at lower temperatures and that it would be less invasive into the central nervous system. The problem with that is that even as it sits in the vial, it reverts back to its old ways before you swallow it. But, you know, what generally happens is that the laboratory created virus will outcompete the wild virus in the population. And it actually does do that. And so the United States, you know, when they tested the sewers, they found that the wild virus decreased and then it was replaced by the vaccine virus. And then there were more cases of vaccine-induced polio from the oral virus than there were wild virus, which is why they stopped giving the oral virus, the oral vaccine, and we're now giving the injected vaccine. And when they test in the sewers, they find, you know, there is no wild polio virus anymore in the United States in our sewers. And the vaccine virus actually seems to have also gone down. However, in other countries, they're finding persistent, mutant vaccine viruses. So either way, you know, the stories are very complicated in that, yes, you know, the vaccines can decline the diseases, but there's always more to the story than people are told, like the paralysis that occurred and like the persistent mutant viruses that occur and the fact that it wasn't actually poliovirus that was causing most of the cases that were terrorizing the world.
Well, what we have now, you talk in your book about acute flaccid paralysis, which is essentially the symptoms of polio without any evidence for the poliovirus, and that's going up quite dramatically around the world, according to the World Health Organization statistics.
Yes, well, it appears as in California, you know, we just had a recent polio-like epidemic, and I just find that it's very interesting that they call it polio-like, because that word incites fear in anybody, right? Even parents who have questioned vaccines. You just mentioned the word polio, and everybody go heading for the hills. And, you know, that fear campaign was very successful. You know, the March of Dimes, basically, you know, there are adults now who report that the March of Dimes would show up at their house and say, you know, we want to put you, these polio kids, we want to put you in these braces and some pretty clothes, and we want you to look as sad as you can. And that fear campaign was meant to make everybody feel like they could be a potential victim, where the truth of it is that, you know, even if poliovirus at its peak when the hysteria was going on, it was actually a very low incidence disease. They called 30 out of 100,000 an epidemic back then.
Right.
You know, think about that. That means that you could basically be living in a big neighborhood and either zero or one people could have been affected by polio.
Right. Well, it's definitely an interesting story, and there's still more coming out. And I think one of the things that happened is that more and more of the scientific literature is getting onto the web, so the need to go to paper libraries is less, and people can do this research a lot more easily. So I'm sure the discussion of things like polio will continue. But let's move further forwards in time. You talk quite a bit about the DPT, what's that, diphtheria, typhus or typhoid, and pertussis.
Pertussis.
Yes.
Pertussis and tetanus. Diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus. Yes.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about that that vaccine and that triple epidemic.
Yeah, again, you know, if you look at the statistics for all these diseases, including whooping cough, in the United States, the mortality rate for that disease had declined by 98% before the vaccine was introduced, or 92%. If you looked at the statistics for England, because they started gathering statistics in 1838,
mm-hmm.
You were dying from everything, scarlet fever, whooping cough, measles. These were all really horrible diseases. Pretty much anything
right.
You got, you could die from. And the mortality rate for, just like measles, whooping cough had declined by over 99% before the vaccine started to being introduced in the public.
Right.
And, you know, again, same thing for measles. Measles has gone about 100% as far as mortality rate.
Right.
But these were considered not major threats by the time they came out with these vaccines. All these diseases, scarlet fever went away without any vaccine. And then there was typhus and typhoid and cholera. You know, these things didn't have vaccines that made a major impact anyway. So, you know,
right.
these
the
things
deaths,
were not...
Let me just want to clarify. It was the deaths from scarlet fever that declined, because the truth is we're still seeing scarlet fever all over the world. We're seeing it in New Zealand, but we're not seeing deaths from it, especially in people who are vitamin C replete. And now we do have antibiotics available, but antibiotics actually don't take care of the problem with scarlet fever, because scarlet fever comes from a virus that infects the bacteria, and it's actually the virus that creates that. So, you know, while you can kill the bacteria, potentially other bacteria will come in and take its place, but it's actually the virus that's causing the toxin, and you don't need to treat it with an antibiotic. And the mortality rate from scarlet fever declined even before antibiotics were invented.
Right. And scarlet fever was a bigger killer in the 1800s than whooping cough or measles or smallpox. I mean, it was a big killer, along with tuberculosis and pneumonia. Those were the big killers. They all went down.
I mean, the thing about the, you know, the whooping cough vaccine is that, you know, people have been very highly compliant with this vaccine. And, you know, we have the highest vaccination rate we've ever had on the planet. And the rates of whooping cough are continuing to go up. So this vaccine, you know, even the most ardent pro-vaccine arguers can't win as far as saying that this vaccine is providing herd immunity. And in fact, you know, there's an article by Warfel, W-A-R-F-E-L, in 2013, where they basically did a study on baboons. Who, you know, these are primates who experience right. whooping cough the same as we do. And they showed that it was actually the vaccinated that were colonized and spread disease for longer than even a naturally infected person when they were sick. But if you compare them with a naturally infected person that has recovered, that person spreads disease for 0 days, while a vaccinated person, when they're re-exposed, spreads disease for between 38 and 42 days. So who's providing herd immunity? Is it the people that are vaccinated, or is it the people that are immune long-term for over 30 years with a solid immunity and don't have any spread of bacteria after re-exposure? That's the question.
Good question.
And one-third of persistent coughs, when you see people coughing and they have this persistent cough for weeks on end, that's the same thing. It's Bordetella pertussis. It's whooping cough.
It's
endemic. It's not been eradicated. It's still around. And this is what I didn't believe when I was starting this research. I thought, well, whooping cough's gone. You don't see people choking to death, and you don't see all these infectious diseases, but whooping cough is still around. Bordetella
pertussis. And if these diseases are less severe, then you either have to hypothesize that the viruses have become less pathogenic, or that human beings are stronger because we're better nourished and live in better housing, which I suspect is your explanation.
Whooping cough bacteria is interesting because, you know, that bacteria has not become any more benign as time has gone on. And in fact, there's evidence that the bacteria has become more virulent from both the vaccine and from the antibiotics, and that the bacteria is escaping antibiotics, and the strains that are now resistant to antibiotics are much more virulent. The thing about whooping cough bacteria is it's a toxin-producing disease. And I have personally treated dozens and dozens of infants and young children and older people, and one case was a newborn, 2 weeks old, with high-dose vitamin C with 100% success rate. There have been no super infections. There have been no hospitalizations, no need for antibiotics. And these are all – some of them have actually been vaccinated. And that's most of the people that call me, their kids got pertussis from somebody who had been vaccinated.
Yes. We only have a couple of minutes left. I didn't read through the entire part of your book. I'm about two-thirds of the way through, but there's been a lot of attention placed on Andrew Wakefield and, you know, what happened to him when he claimed that the MMR vaccine was causing bowel problems in children. I don't even claim that, but he noted that there were children who'd been vaccinated who had bowel problems and they'd received the MMR vaccine. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, I think Andrew Wakefield has really said enough for himself, and there are, you know, plenty of videos out there that people can watch as far as that is concerned. And that's really about all I have to say about, you know, we have a little bit of information on what happened with him. You know, I really believe that the reason he was pursued was because He had a study that was on the eve of being published that showed that primates that were given the infant vaccine schedule showed differences in their brain scans and their survival reflexes and their suckling reflexes, and that he had to be taken down because of that. And, you know, somebody in his position who was basically, all he said was that, you know, he was a pro-vaccine doctor. He said we need to be giving the measles vaccine as a separate vaccine, not with mumps and rubella. And it's an incredibly complicated story politically and medically that I suggest people go and read about themselves.
Yes. Well, speaking of reading, we're coming to the end of the show, and I would just like to encourage everybody who's interested in vaccines to read your book, Dissolving Illusions. And you mentioned that dissolvingillusions.com is
right.
The website.
Right. The website has all the graphs in full color, so you can print them out or whatever you want to do with them.
Okay.
Also, the book is available on Amazon and in Kindle, too, for people who like
okay,
that type of thing.
Okay. Well, the book itself is about, looks like about the size of three Kindles. So,
well, you know, there's a lot of references, over 800 references.
Yeah.
And we were meticulous on referencing everything, and there's a lot of direct quotes. There's a lot of graphs in there. If you take out all the references and graphs that take up a lot of the book, I mean, it's
and
not...
And the photos, lots of photos.
Right, and the photos.
Yeah, I mean,
so
it's
not
easy,
as, it's not as
read.
Of a
it's
massive
a,
read as it might first appear.
Yeah, no, it's. I found it easy to read, but there is a lot of history, and there's a lot of historical stories plus a lot of explanations of the scientific aspects. So I would definitely... encourage people to read this. I think it's really important to have open discussions about this. I follow quite a bit of mainstream media, and I see them talk about vaccines, and they're always talking about, you know, anti-vax wackos or whatever, and they always drag out Jenny McCarthy and people who are not, you know, scientific spokesmen. They never will admit that there are people who are academically
trained. Those are easy punching bags, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And it's marketing 101. Create anxiety, provide a solution. You create anxiety about all these conditions, and then we have the solution. Here's our vaccine. So that's been going on for a long time.
Yes. Yeah. It's really very sad, because I would like to have a scientific discussion about vaccines. And my kids were vaccinated because I didn't really know all of this. But if now I know what I know, I would definitely not have my kids receive at least most of the vaccines that are proposed, especially in the United States.
I think everybody needs to do their research, and we spend a long time doing this research. So there's a lot of information people can draw upon and really think about what you're doing. Don't just follow what people tell you to do.
And if there's areas that are interesting, you know, because you've included so many references, people can chase down other areas. So I would just like to thank you for joining me today, and I really appreciate this discussion.
Thanks for having us.
I also appreciate our audience, so don't forget to listen next week at the same time to The Infectious Myth. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks. Bye.